gets business done quickly, invests the key with enough intent to spring the lock open. "Kalorak will take your soul," the woman growls, showing off her rotten teeth. "Nakothi and Othagor will share your body between them. That which sleeps will soon wake." If she weren't soulbound, he would kill her now. But her powers might be useful in the future, so he twists the key again, willing it to seal the door. The lock snaps shut without a hitch. If it had come from anyone except the Emperor, the vision would never have held so much detail. Genuine imperial artifacts, tools used by the Emperor in his everyday life, and thus harboring a measure of his limitless intent, were not so rare, despite imperial efforts to eradicate them entirely. But every reader wanted them. A cloth used by the Emperor to dry his sweat could be a more powerful object than an awakened weapon produced by a lesser reader. In the search for such artifacts, Calder had often followed trails of debris that the Emperor had incidentally brushed, a cobblestone on which he'd stepped, a sign he'd pushed past on a crowded street. With anyone else, such brief and accidental contact would leave no residue, but this was the Emperor. Anything he did left his surroundings more significant than before. Thus armed with a library of glimpses, whispers, and half-visions of the Emperor, Calder had assembled something like a picture of the man. He was confident that he knew the Emperor as well as anyone else outside the Imperial Court, and he was becoming convinced the man was a monster. He unlocks the dungeon, wishing he could leave this task to someone else. But this prison alone, of all the prisons in the world, he has to maintain personally. This is where he keeps people who have found his secrets. Those who pass this door only do so once. Calder didn't know how the key to the Emperor's personal dungeon had fallen outside the Imperial Court. Usually, the Emperor would destroy anything that might harbor such sensitive intent. Roderick, guided by his son, had picked it up from a dredger along with a bucketful of other junk. If the Emperor learned of this key, he might consider it dangerous. Having read it might be more of a crime than Roderick's. He indulged himself in a brief fantasy of blackmailing the Emperor into commuting his father's sentence, but he quickly brought himself back on track. The Emperor would have them both killed. That was the most frightening thing he'd learned from handling the key. The Emperor was capable of anything, and in a prison run by him, no inmate survived. So what about Calder's father, locked in Candle Bay Imperial Prison? He was convicted of a crime against the Emperor's person, after all, though attempted purchase of an imperial possession was among the least of the crimes in that category. Would the Emperor find out about Roderick? If he did, Calder was certain that his father would die in that cell. Perhaps it would take a few decades, but the Emperor did not tolerate personal insults. Calder would have to do something. Olsa knocked twice, sharply, and then entered without waiting. Hurriedly, Calder stuffed the key into the invested shirt pocket that had become its permanent home. "Up," she declared, throwing the curtains wide. "Your tutors arrive today." He scrambled out of bed, eager to see the guildsman she'd hired.
"Tutors? I thought there was to be only one."
"In a sense, there is. I've retained the services of a pair of witnesses. They've worked with the Black Watch before, and they were looking for a seasonal job over the next 4 or 5 years."
She began plucking clothes out of his wardrobe, laying them out on the bed while he waited awkwardly nearby.
"Isn't that what the servants are for?"
he asked. She didn't look up from her work, smoothing out the wrinkles in a navy blue walking jacket.
"It's been almost 10 years since I've seen my son. I let the servants choose your clothes when you were very young, and in the years since, I have come to regret that."
Olsa gave the clothes one last pat, as though to finish them off, and then smiled over at him.
"Hurry up and dress. Our guests will be joining us for breakfast."
As soon as the door was shut, Calder stuffed his shirt, along with the key, into the drawer at the base of the wardrobe. He had made it very clear that the drawer was filled with his private possessions, and she had promised to honor his privacy. But he still invested the pocket every morning, just in case. One never knew when the Imperial Guard might come around, asking questions. Last night, Calder had expected one guest this morning, his new tutor. A few minutes ago, when he found out about the pair of witnesses, he had expected two. Now, to his surprise, he found that they had three. The witnesses sat together on one side of the table, next to his mother at the head. A pair of dark-skinned Heartlanders, they were also brothers, Arthur and Voris Belfry.
"It is quite common for siblings to join the witnesses together," Arthur explained, lifting a forkful of fruit salad to his mouth.
His shirt strained at the seam from the pressure of his bicep, which was bigger around than Calder's neck. He must have stood almost 7 feet tall and heavier than three of Calder's father.
"I am the chronicler,"
Arthur went on.
"I read and record imperial history as I witness it. Then I spread that knowledge to others."
He patted his belt, which was lined with candles. All but one were wrapped in brown paper. The single bare cylinder of wax was snow-white and half-burnt.
"My brother is my silent one, my guide and bodyguard. He covers his mouth as a symbol of his refusal to speak secrets."
From size alone, Calder would have expected Arthur to be fighting as a champion in an arena, not recording history. Except that gladiators were almost always descended from the light-haired Azirian tribes, not citizens of the civilized Aurelian heartlands. But his brother, Voris, looked like a sparrow in glasses. Voris adjusted his spectacles when he was mentioned, then he tugged his scarf down to take a bite of his muffin. He pulled the scarf back up to chew. The silent one was much taller than Calder, but just as thin. Where Arthur looked like he could push a bull up a mountain, Voris looked as though he would have trouble sliding his plate across the table. Which of them was supposed to be the bodyguard? As interesting as the two witnesses were, they couldn't hold Calder's attention compared to their third guest. Jyreen Tasella was exactly his age, the daughter of a watchman who had died in the line of duty.
"Her father was a close friend of mine,"
Alsa had said during Jyreen's introduction.
"She could never afford an education without his income, and a tutor can teach two students as well as one."
Calder had certainly not complained. Between her tanned skin and long braid of brown hair, her dangling emerald earrings, and her bold smile, she was like the genteel version of those Vandenian dancers his father admired.
"In a few years, she'll turn heads," his father would have said.
She was turning Calder's head already. Arthur took a sip of tea gently, as though he were afraid he might crush the cup in his grip.
"So, children, let's get to know one another. You are both familiar with the works of Sedesthenes, yes?"
"Of course,"
Jyreen said.
"Why do the petty tribes of the earth waste their time on war?" Calder quoted. "Don't they know that their struggles must end the same way, in a single empire for all the world?"
Voris shook his head, still chewing behind his scarf.
"That's an impressive quotation from Prion the IV,"
Alsa said, her eyes on her meal.
"He wrote a continent away from Sedesthenes and a century apart."
Jyreen's earrings caught the light as she grinned at Calder.
"Oh, but I see what you mean. They had practically identical views on imperial conquest. Both of them saw the Emperor's expansion as a natural part of the universe, decreed by fate."
Arthur suppressed his own smile, shaking his empty fork in Jyreen's direction.
"That is exactly what Calder meant, I have no doubt."
Right then, Calder vowed to read more of Sedesthenes.
"We will still cover Sedesthenes, I think, simply to enhance your familiarity. We can take a look at the foundational works of the other philosophers as well, and you can let us know if one in particular piques your interest."
He speared a slice of apple, moving it to his plate.
"And since the philosophies rely so heavily on imperial history, we will study that at the same time. Of course, that's more Voris' area of expertise than mine, isn't it?"
Arthur returned to his plate, slicing his apple into bite-sized pieces. Voris, of course, said nothing. After a few seconds of crippling silence, Arthur chuckled.
"Just a little joke, I apologize. We do tease one another."
His brother pulled out a book and started reading, ignoring Arthur entirely. Jyreen leaned forward, both elbows on the table.
"Before we get to history and philosophy, I want to hear your stories. You two have been all over the Empire, haven't you?"
"Yes,"
Calder piped up, eager to rejoin the conversation.
"I've heard about the chroniclers and their candles. Is it true that you can store memories?"
Both witnesses turned to Calder's mother, who stared at her son.
"He didn't hear about it from me,"
Alsa said pointedly.
Calder, who told you that?
His father had, of course, but Calder did what he always did when he wanted to deflect more questions.
He smiled. I've always been fascinated by the witnesses, and I've tried to learn everything I could about them. Rumor only, of course, but I'm always hungry to learn more about the guilds. Mother, didn't we speak the other day about the possibility of my joining the Guild of Witnesses?
We did indeed, she said dryly.
Jirene's eyes widened.
It's true, then? You can store memories in the wax of a candle?
Arthur sighed, glancing at his silent brother.
It is not something we advertise, but it is also not quite a secret. There is no such thing as perfect memory, so we devised an alchemical wax that is particularly sensitive to intent. It can record a few days' worth of memories, so that when I burn the candles later, I relive the events exactly as they occurred. Thereby, I ensure the accuracy of my own recollection.
She placed a hand on Calder's, excited.
That's incredible. I've never heard of such a thing.
As she did, Calder noticed a spidery tattoo on her left hand. The line of script, which was nothing like standard Imperial, began under the nail of each finger and crawled along the back of her hand, joining into one stream that vanished into her left sleeve. He flushed at the contact.
It is, isn't it? It's one of the reasons I find the witnesses so fascinating.
Under her breath, also grunted. Jirene gave her tutors a charming smile.
Will you burn one for us sometime? I'd love to relive a battle, or a chimera hunt, or a duel.
Arthur drained the last of his tea.
The realm has been peaceful for the duration of our career. We have only been forced to fight a small number of times, and nothing you might call a battle.
Suddenly, the witnesses actually did seem like an interesting career choice.
Fights, you say?
Voris gave them a disapproving look over his glasses, and his brother seemed to agree.
I expected a boy to be interested in foolish violence, but a young lady ought to have more sense.
Jirene looked hungry for every word.
Does Voris do all the fighting, or do you fight back to back?
Today, I thought we would cover an introduction to philosophy, Arthur said firmly.
As one, Jirene and Calder sighed. Olsa stood up from the table, waving at a maid to clean her place.
I have to be going. There's a guild project that will not wait for me any longer.
As she walked past him, Olsa ruffled Calder's hair.
Try not to spend too long on war stories, will you, Arthur?
Of course not, madam,
the chronicler said, unfolding from his chair and drawing himself up straight.
And my thanks for serving the Empire as faithfully as you have.
Olsa waved behind her as she left. As soon as she was gone, a question leapt from Jirene's mouth.
She works for the Black Watch. What does she do exactly? I've heard such stories.
Don't ask me, Calder said. I've never heard except that it involves something called a whispering gaunt. Arthur shivered, and Voris made a strange sign in the air. He drew a circle with his fingers, roughly parallel with his own face.
It's best not to speak of such things, Arthur said.
Like a cat spying a mouse's tail, Jirene pounced.
What such things? My father would never tell me either.
How can we avoid a subject if we don't know which subject to avoid? Calder joined in. Between the two of them, Arthur wilted.
What do you know about the Black Watch?
They defend us from the elders,
Jirene said.
They worship elders and drink human blood,
Calder whispered. Jirene pointed at Calder without taking her eyes from Arthur.
His version sounds more colorful.
More colorful usually means less correct, the tutor responded. It is my job to make sure that you are operating on accurate information, and I do happen to know quite a bit about the Black Watch.
Both Jirene and Calder leaned forward further, scenting weakness. Then Arthur held up a book, a copy of Sedestany's From Rising Sun to Setting Moon.
When we reach the end of each chapter, I would be happy to answer one question from each of you, without violating any guild secrets, of course.
Calder slumped in his chair, disappointed, but Jirene narrowed her eyes.
What if we have more questions?
The chronicler grinned.
Fortunately for you, I have more books.
Chapter 7. Present Day.
For a navigator, Calder wasn't a very good navigator. That had been Jerry's job more than his. reading the maps and the stars, comparing them to the compass, telling him which direction to go as he steered the ship. She was the pilot. He was just the captain. Without her, he had to rely on Nabarius and occasional input from Andal. Therefore, he was effectively taking it on faith that they were headed the right direction. At the moment, he had focused his entire body and intent to steering the Testament through the starlight spires, mountainous spikes of some silvery metal that stuck up from the water like a forest of titanic needles. At night, the spires supposedly lit up with spots of white light as though they were covered in stars, but Calder would rather swim through than try and navigate these turns after sundown. Some of the silver spires were too close to one another to squeeze through, and others didn't reach entirely out of the water. Off to port, he saw the sun-bleached remnants of a ship that hadn't cleared one of the sunken spires, so the metal spike had gouged a chunk out of the hull and left the corpse of the vessel impaled forever. It didn't look like a navigator ship, so it was that captain's own fault for venturing this far into the Aeon. Still, it was a grim reminder of what could happen if Calder lost concentration for a moment. He couldn't rely on the Lyathaton to pull them through either. Alien irritation flowed up through the ship, burning Calder's mind with its sullen resentment. The Elder was not at all happy that it had to dodge around sunken silver spikes so it couldn't spend the day sleeping as it normally did. If Calder called upon the Lyathaton now, he had the uncomfortable feeling that he'd end up dining with Kellerak on the bottom of the sea. Dalton Foster stomped up the ladder to the stern deck, cradling a musket in one arm and a bottle in the other. Calder nodded to him without taking his eyes from the closest silver spire. "Duster," he said pointedly. Foster had a history of forgetting his false name. The old gunner grunted. "So, it's been a week." Aching pain shot through Calder's gut, but he kept his expression blank. He'd tried to spend the last week distracting himself with work, and the crew had mostly stayed out of his way. He should have known it was too good to last. "We probably have another week until we get there," Calder said, in an attempt to keep the conversation on their voyage. At another time of the year, the trip wouldn't have taken so long. The coordinates Nabarius pointed out on the map were at the very edge of what navigators called the Deep Aeon. It was far enough into the sea that only members of Calder's guild could get there, but still only a few days from shore in a straight line. The straight line part was what got people killed. This time of year, a deep strider migration ran parallel to the coast, and the Chimera would reduce his ship to matchsticks if he tried to sail right through them. He'd heard rumors that Lirin Island had drifted west, so he'd have to spend another few days looping wide enough around the island. He didn't want his crew to start eating each other, as the last navigators to land on the nomadic isle had, and he couldn't move at full speed through the silver spires. All in all, it turned a 4-day trip into a 2-week voyage. Traveling through the Aeon Sea often boiled down to nothing more than choosing between one delay, a longer delay, and a horrible death. Foster grunted again, looking down at the pair of spectacles hanging against his beard.
I brought you something. He held out the bottle.
Calder angled the ship to take them into a relatively clear stretch of water, and then took a hand from the wheel to examine Foster's gift. It looked like an undersized wine bottle with a white label that read simply, Batch 419. He tugged out the cork and took a swig, expecting the bitter wash of cheap wine. Instead, he was greeted by a wash of fruity flavor that reminded him of peach. When did we get a vintage like this?
Alchemical wine? He asked curiously. After a second, he took another drink.
His parents would both have been offended for different reasons. His mother would have argued that he was abusing the wine by drinking it directly from the bottle, and his father would have wanted him to share.
Foster shrugged. How should I know? I got it from Petal.
Calder sprayed a mouthful of orange wine over the deck.
Not good. Oh, well, I'm sure she's got more. I thought, you might like to hit some targets for a while.
Foster hefted the musket. Calder ignored him, focusing on his body. Did he feel a warmth running through his veins?
Was it poison? Something worse? Should he lock himself in the hold? Duster, what was in that?
The gunner frowned, confused.
Wine? If Petal put nothing else in that bottle, I'll give you my share from this job.
Foster reached into his jacket, pulling out a few rolled-up papers that looked as though they'd been torn from a book.
She wouldn't poison you. You know that.
In point of fact, he didn't know that. He held up the papers on which he'd drawn targets.
Where do you want me to set these up?
Calder adjusted their course to keep them from running into a partially submerged spire.
I'm a little busy here, Duster. If I stopped to shoot for an hour, we'd all be dead.
Foster shifted from foot to foot, looking at his handful of targets.
It helped me, he said at last.
Calder stopped. If anyone understood how he was feeling, it was Foster. He'd earned a reputation as a world-class gunsmith, which had made him quite a fortune among the Empire's elite. It was considered a distinction to own a Dalton Foster original. But that was before the Emperor's death. Afterwards, until the four regents and the Imperial Guard restored order, the capital had spent a few months swallowed in chaos. An opportunist had found Foster, kidnapped his family, and forced him to make a gun. Every day until he'd finished, Foster's family was tortured. Not all of them made it. The survivors, scarred and scared, had abandoned Dalton Foster, his own wife and children. As far as Calder knew, the man hadn't seen or heard from them for years. Calder's lips stretched into a grin. Foster scowled, crumbling the targets in his fist.
Something funny, Captain.
He shook his head furiously, still grinning.
No, it's... I can't stop smiling.
Out on the deck, a frizzy head poked up through the trap door to the hold. Petal looked at him with beady eyes and then hurriedly ducked back down.
Ah, Dalton said. So that's what was in the wine.
For Petal, it was actually pretty good logic. If Calder wasn't happy, then slip him some sort of concoction to make him smile. He'd have to watch his food for the next few days. Once she found out this batch hadn't worked, she would try a newer version.
Thanks for trying, Foster. Some other time, perhaps.
The words might have sounded a little less ridiculous if Calder wasn't smiling like a jester. Foster nodded and walked off. Calder honestly couldn't tell if the man was offended or relieved. A hand clapped him on the back, sending him crashing into the wheel.
It is good to see you smiling again, Captain. The worse life gets, the better it is to smile.
True to his word, Urzaiah was grinning as he loomed over Calder, proudly displaying his two missing teeth. He planted hands on his hips, showing off his huge arms, one wrapped in leather, the other in gold-scaled hide. Calder considered explaining about Petal and the wine, but decided it wasn't worth the trouble. Knowing Urzaiah, he might think it was a great idea.
A week is enough time for grieving,
Urzaiah said, leaning back with his elbows against the railing.
Now it is time to move on.
Calder turned his manic grin on his cook.
You think so, do you? You misunderstand me, I think. Do not move on to a different wife. I have found it is best to do that slowly. Move on to the next step.
The next step. Urzaiah's smile was almost as broad as Calder's.
Vengeance.
Calder hadn't thought of anything else for the past week. He wasn't sure who deserved revenge the most. The consultant, Shara? She was the one who had attacked them while they were sleeping, taking his wife from him. But consultants didn't work on their own. Who had hired her? Surely they were the ones who really deserved a lead ball in the heart. Then there was Jerry herself. The Sleepless were elder-worshipping cultists, and Calder had fought against them before, with Jerry at his side. Was she one of them back then, or had she joined them afterwards? That which sleeps will soon wake. Could she have used that line to deceive the assassin, Shara? But why? What would that accomplish? The fact remained that she was still a soulbound. She had still been lying to him for years, perhaps from the first moment they'd met in his mother's dining room. He needed some explanation, any explanation. If it turned out that she had never loved him and had stuck with him only as part of a long-running elder plot, even knowing that would be better than nothing. Good, clean pain would be better than this storm of confusion. Calder didn't understand his own feelings anymore. He only knew that he would never be satisfied until he found Jerry. Urzaiah pulled out one of his black hafted hatchets, laying it across his palms.
It was my fault.
Calder turned on him, surprised. Thanks to Petal's potion, he didn't look shocked. He looked delighted.
Yours?
The woodsman looked up, and Calder realized he was talking to a different person. Not his cheerful cook, Urziah, but the Azirian gladiator. Banished to the arena in the hopes that the fights would kill him, Urziah Woodsman had managed to survive for over a year against unstoppable odds. And a single assassin had rendered him unconscious from the shadows.
Urziah, no. If she had stayed to fight you, you would have torn her apart, and she knew that. It's why she took you out first.
Urziah looked down at his hatchet.
There were poisoners in the arena. They tried to hide and poison me. It has never stopped me before.
Trust me, the cook cut him off,
and it will not stop me now. Jairine has secrets from you. This is not good, but every man has secrets. You two will talk, and you will work it out. Once I have killed the consultant and brought Jairine home.
Calder simply nodded, grinning like an idiot.
A champion does not fail, even one in disgrace, you understand?
Urziah slid his hatchet back over his shoulder.
I like you like this, smiling all the time. This is how you should be. I will tell Petal to drug you more.
Only a few minutes later, he got another visit, and this one was unexpected. Tristania walked up the short ladder to the stern deck, standing by the wheel and looking at him. Just looking.
What can I do for you?
He asked, smiling involuntarily. He was not surprised when the silent one said nothing. She simply stood there, watching him. Bandages shuffled as she shifted her weight, and her coat flapped behind her in the sea breeze like a flag. Little wisps of black hair stuck out of the wrapping covering her head, and her eyes, peeking out from between two white strips of cloth, her eyes were soft and sympathetic, which made her silence all the more off-putting. He coughed politely, trying to signal her to do something, though he was afraid his alchemy-induced smile was sending the wrong message. After a few seconds of standing and looking, she reached into her coat and pulled out a blanket. It wasn't particularly cold out, but he wondered if she wanted to sit on the deck, maybe make it a picnic of sorts and stare at him all afternoon. He didn't object to women looking at him usually, but this time the thought disturbed him. But she didn't spread the blanket out on the deck. Instead, she wrapped it around his shoulders, pressing in the corners like a mother tucking her child in to sleep. He wasn't quite sure why until she finished, patting him on the shoulder. She let her hand linger there, squeezing as if to give him strength, and then left. For some reason, he had to blink back tears. Hours passed after Tristania's visit, and Calder's peace was not disturbed by anything more pressing than deadly metal spikes. He kept wearing the blanket. The sun glowed red behind him, and faint white lights appeared on the silver spires. He understood the rumors now. The lights did look like stars, and they didn't seem to be simple quick lamps set into the silver. Thousands of white sparks covered each towering spire, swirling slightly like fireflies trapped in a mirror. The show was faint, competing with the setting sun for attention, but he could easily imagine that the sight would be breathtaking in full darkness. Not that he had any intention of remaining in this maze when night fell. The spires would light his way, certainly, but he feared they would play tricks on his eyes, driving him to impale his ship. Worse, he could think of several creatures in the Aeon that hunted by night, lured to a glow on the surface of the water. They would be swirling around the spires only minutes after sunset, hunting. At last, the spires began to thin. Only one tilted silver spike loomed ahead of him and one more beneath. After that, they'd be clear. Calder's attention sharpened. He'd learned the hard way that you had to focus most carefully when it seemed you were safe. That's where a trap would do the most harm. It helped that Petal's potion had finally started to wear off, so his lips only occasionally smiled without permission. He scanned the water for suspicious shadows, keeping half his mind on the Lyathaton. If anything disturbed the Elder, he wanted to know about it as soon as possible. So he didn't notice Andal until the quartermaster stood 2 feet away, brushing a smudge from his white sleeve.
Sir, Andal said, by way of greeting.
Andal?
Normally, they would have traded jokes, but Calder was focused on navigation. It was the perfect excuse. This was the conversation Calder had dreaded, and the one that he'd known was coming for over a week. No one ever liked hearing, "I told you so."
"The others have all said their piece by now," Andal said, still looking straight at the darkening horizon.
"Not Petal."
"She didn't drug you. That should tell you something."
"She did drug me."
"If you're still standing, it doesn't count."
Calder gave a smile that was only half potion-induced. This easy, comfortable exchange reminded him of the old Andal. Maybe this wouldn't be as bad as he feared. Andal might not have a well-deserved lecture in mind after all.
"I've waited a week to speak with you,"
Andal went on, and Calder slumped against the wheel.
"Must we, Andal? I know what you want to say. How about we both pretend you've already said it?"
Andal Patronus was many things, but he was not easily dissuaded.
"You're angry now, but I don't think you know who deserves it most."
"Thank you for that analysis. If we could save the rest of this conversation for another time."
"I'm sorry that we don't know if Jyrene is dead or alive. I wish we could have dealt with this another way. But for your sake, I am glad she's gone."
The potion twitched Calder's lips up, and he embraced it, bearing a shark's grin. He sent his intent down into the boards of the testament, and his soulbound vessel responded. The seamless wood of the ship's deck rippled under Andal's feet like the surface of a struck lake. He stumbled and fell over backwards, hat rolling off his head. Calder leaned over him.
"Do not say that again, Andal. Not to me, and not on my ship."
From his seat on the deck, Andal made himself comfortable. He crossed his legs under him and looked up, seemingly unmoved.
"Years ago, when I was a ship's boy on a merchant vessel out of Delia, the first mate of that ship took me in, raised me like a father. From him, I learned something very important. More than enforcing the captain's orders, more than keeping the rest of the crew in line, the mate's job is to keep the captain in check. It's to tell the captain when he's on the wrong course, and when he's going to get himself and everyone else on board killed."
Andal's expression was calm, but firm. He was merely stating a fact.
"Captain, you're on the wrong course. You're going to kill us."
Speaking of courses, Calder reminded himself to check their heading. He busied himself at the wheel with a compass, checking their position and scanning the water for any outlying spires. It seemed they were mostly in the clear, which meant he had nothing to distract him from Andal.
"You're my quartermaster," Calder said first, "not my first mate." "Am I not?"
His emotions demanded that he shout and rail at the man, maybe use the deck to toss him around some more. The water seemed relatively clear. Maybe a dunk would teach him that Calder was the one in charge here. But the greater part of him recognized the childlike impulse for what it was and crushed it. Andal's advice had saved his life on more than one occasion. What was the point of having a cool-headed advisor if you never listened to his advice? He prepared himself with a deep breath.
"I apologize, Mr. Patronus. Please continue."
Andal bowed slightly, still seated.
"You know I've never trusted Jyrene, and you know I had my reasons."
Despite his attempts to ignore it, anger still seethed in Calder's chest. Was Andal really trying to provoke him?
"Continue," Calder said tightly. "I am setting all of that aside. Let's assume that Jyrene was completely justified in keeping secrets and that her loyalty is beyond question."
"Yes, let's assume that."
"Then we're left with a few things to consider. First, why did the consultant take Jyrene captive? For that matter, why did an assassin capture anyone at all?"
It was a good question, but not a new one. "We've run down that road already, Andal."
"All right, then let's move past the consultant's intentions. What are the actual results of her actions? She has someone to interrogate, so we can assume that she'll know everything about our capabilities."
Calder tried very hard not to picture Jerry's interrogation.
"And you are left in the position of wanting to recover your wife more than anything else. More than delivering the passenger. More than getting paid. More, even, than arriving safely at our destination. One way or another, that means that you will be trying to speak with Shera. True so far?"
"True enough," Calder admitted. He hadn't thought of it in so many words, but all of his plans for Shira the Consultant involved capturing her or otherwise tricking her into spilling Jerry's location.
If she had not captured Jairine, would you care about talking with her?
With an assassin? He wouldn't want to get within earshot of the woman. No, I would not.
Instead, how would you deal with her?
Calder considered for a moment, letting the testament drift of its own accord out to the relatively clear ocean. The Lyathaton had begun to sink back into sleep. Avoid her, if at all possible, Calder said at last. I'd try to dock somewhere she didn't expect, stay somewhere she wouldn't think to check, move the crew as a whole instead of splitting up so we weren't vulnerable. If that didn't work, I'd try to trap her, pretend we thought we were safe and have Urzaya and Foster ambush her. Andal nodded, still seated.
And now, instead of doing what the trained assassin least expects, we're going exactly where she wants us to go.
Realization settled on Calder's shoulders like a sack of bricks. Andal was right. They were playing right into the enemy's hands, which he would never have done if Jerry weren't in danger. But they had to. This was the only way to find Jerry.
That, Andal said, is how you're going to get us all killed.
For the next few minutes, with Andal sitting next to him, Calder steered in relative quiet. The wind flapped in the sails, and the waves still lapped against the hull. Behind him, Nabarius and Tristania chatted about something. The clink of iron told him that Foster was working downstairs, and a snatch of some Isirian battle song meant that Urzaya had begun working on dinner. Calder's thoughts ran in circles. He didn't want to put the crew in danger, but he didn't want to leave Jerry in danger. He was making no progress when he finally sighed and looked down at Andal. You're right, Andal. I'll think about it.
We've got a little time. Assuming you don't drive us straight into a reef, we're not likely to die tonight.
From up in the crow's nest, a deafening masculine voice bellowed out, Die tonight! Then a black shadow bobbed down, fluttering across the reddened sky until Shuffles landed on Calder's shoulder. It turned its scowling black eyes to Calder, wiggling its tentacles. In case he didn't hear it the first time, it shouted, Die tonight! One more time straight into his ear. Andal jumped to his feet, placing the white hat on his head. In volume no less than the Elder Spawn, he announced,
Danger! All hands on deck! All hands on deck! That means you too, Petal!
Foster was already climbing up to the crow's nest, musket and powder horn in hand. Urzaya strode up to the bow, a black hatchet in each hand. Petal snuck up the ladder carrying a crate of bottles, a rat curled up on top of them like a sleeping cat. Nabarius marched over, wearing his red suit again and resting one hand on his pistol. Tristania followed him, staring through her bandages into the waters.
What danger? Nabarius asked. What do you see?
Nothing, Calder said. The Aeon Sea seemed to be playing nice for the moment.
Then why?
Andal jerked a thumb at Calder's shoulder.
The Elderspawn only wakes up from a nap if it thinks we're all going to die.
And it's in a good mood this time, Calder added. That means it's nearby. On his chiseled actor's face, Nabarius' expression of confusion looked like it had come off of a classical painting. Portrait of a hero in distress, perhaps. Distantly, a storm of glowing, sulfur-yellow clouds began to gather on the dark eastern horizon. They pulled together like threads of shining, unnatural mist.
Name an elder and he appears, Calder muttered.
Worm cloud,
Andal announced, and the crew all made some sound in acknowledgement. Nabarius cleared his throat.
What in the Emperor's name is a worm cloud?
There was no point in trying to outrun a worm cloud. It would only follow them, so Calder steered straight for it.
If I'm not mistaken, Nabarius, you're about to find out.
When the worms began to rain from the sky, the crew of the Testament was ready. Calder kept his three-cornered hat on and his cutlass in hand, waiting for the worms to drop to the deck. They landed with a splat, little fat grubs the size of a man's foot with a single horn on their heads. Yellow light, exactly matching the unnatural cloud overhead, rippled inside their squishy bodies. They squeaked while squirming across the deck, searching for the nearest source of warm blood. He slashed one in half, spilling its yellow blood over the deck. The color reminded him of the storm wing, but while the chimera gave off a bright and clean light, the worms were dim and sulfurous. He crushed another under his boot and sent a mental pulse to the ship that made the railings surge up, tossing a third worm into the sea.
Three!
He called. Petal moved from worm to worm with a rubber bulb dropper, planting a single drop of acid on the back of each creature. She spoke weakly as she moved.
Four, five, six.
Five,
Andal announced, kicking a worm over the edge. Urzaya did not wear a hat. He stood with a hatchet in each hand, pacing the deck with eyes on the sky. When a worm fell anywhere close to him, one of his blades left a black blur and two squishy halves fell to the wood.
I believe that makes 11,
he yelled, splattered with drops of luminous blood. A musket cracked overhead, and one of the worms exploded into goo. It had been distressingly close to Calder's face. He winced back, glaring up at the crow's nest.
Seriously, Duster? Get down here and use your boots like a human being!
Foster lifted his second musket, tracking another worm.
Sorry, Captain. Every problem is best solved with firepower.
For the first time in over a week, Calder let himself relax. Worm clouds weren't the friendliest things in the world, but they were among the least harmful hazards of the Aeon. Over the years, he'd begun to look forward to the break. Nabarius and Tristania, by contrast, stood back to back on the same cask. The silent one held a reversed broom and was using the wooden haft to crush any worms that got too close. The chronicler held a pistol in each shaking hand, though at least he wasn't firing and reloading as fast as he could, like Foster.
Is this an attack?
Nabarius asked, his voice higher pitched than normal. Calder swept a worm from his hat and then impaled it with his cutlass.
12. And no, Nabarius, this is the Aeon.
I've heard that worm clouds stem from Kathanikar,
Andal said, as he casually strolled over a pair of worms, popping them.
That when the Emperor struck him down, the Great Elder personally blighted the weather.
Calder thought about it for a moment. That would make sense. Worm clouds, the worm lord. But I thought Kathanikar's tomb was in northern Azeria.
13.
16. And how should I know where the Great Elders died? If only there were a member of the Black Watch around, so that we could ask him.
Calder gestured to his own expression, which had been caught in the grip of the poison again. I may be smiling, but don't think that means you're funny. Petal perked up.
I can make it so that you laugh, instead.
No, thank you, Petal. This is quite enough for now. Nabarius kicked a worm off the barrel, but at least he hadn't shot anyone yet.
So, these worms are harmless?
Oh no, not at all, Calder answered. They have a venomous sting that increases your body temperature. The infected, without exception, hurl themselves into the sea within minutes. The chronicler glanced up nervously.
Does that help them?
Calder let his awareness drift down through the ship, along the chains that bound the Lyathaton, until he was reading the awareness of the Elder itself. Glowing worms swirl in the water, moving in a swarm that matches the cloud above. The ones that fall from the sky are only larvae. These are the true children of Kathanikar, the great worms. Each individual has a row of razor-sharp teeth in its circular mouth, and their hunger presses against the Lyathaton's skin like volcanic heat. Any one of them is thicker than the mast of the ship above, and long enough to wrap the Lyathaton completely in its coils. There are hundreds in the water. The Lyathaton bares its own teeth, opening its spirit. Let these lesser creatures, these pathetic parasites born in a world of weakness, feel its contempt. Let them feel the malice, the hunger, the hatred of centuries. They may be able to shred humans to pieces, but one might as well brag about swatting fleas or crushing blades of grass. The worms are all but mindless, knowing nothing but the need to feed. They still know enough to keep their distance, waiting for prey to fall outside of the Lyathaton's reach.
No, Calder said at last. It doesn't help.
Nabarius was obviously confused, but Andal took over.
We have an accomplished alchemist on board, with an antidote prepared. There is a gap of several minutes between when you are stung and when you start trying to throw yourself overboard. And the worms themselves are slow, stupid, and easy to kill.
Easy to kill,
Shuffles chuckled. It swooped down on a worm, scooping the treat up with its tentacles and returning to a perch where it could enjoy its snack.
26! Urzaya yelled. Do not worry, Nabarius. There are worse dangers than these in the Aeon Sea. This is simply a game.
Nabarius recovered his composure and hopped off his cask, crushing a worm beneath him.
In that case, 31.
Petal pointed a finger at him, accusing.
Cheetah!
He shrugged.
She's my silent one. Surely our scores should count together. From terrified to cheating in 5 seconds,
Andal said.
You adapt quickly. I accepted that you were right. Mild peril like this should not shake my composure, particularly not considering what lies ahead.
Calder looked up, mentally ordering his vessel to sweep a handful of worms away from him with a length of rope.
Now there's an interesting subject. What does lie ahead, Nabarius?
Nabarius stayed silent for a few seconds, the odd worm still falling to the deck behind him, and then nodded.
We're close enough that I believe it's safe to tell you. We traveled to the island where Nakothi herself was buried. The island was warped by her influence until it resembles little more than a corpse itself. I have only visited the place once in person, but we were set upon by monstrosities.
He shuddered, though Calder was sure he had faked the gesture.
Children of the dead mother, hideous beasts that haunt my nightmares. Mark my words. What we see on the island will make this worm cloud seem like a pleasant spring rain. You will all earn your fees then.
Chapter 8. Certain objects share the mysterious powers of elders or chimera. These are usually made from remnants of the creature's body. A sword made from a nightworm's claw, for instance, or a pendant made from Lyethaton scales. These items have mysterious and anomalous effects and should be treated with caution. However, when such objects are awakened, a mysterious phenomenon can be observed. Under specific conditions, a human being can be bound to these powerful objects during the awakening procedure. Afterwards, that person can draw on that item as a source of power. We call such people soulbound, and such objects vessels. I believe that somewhere in this process lies the key to traveling the Aeon Sea. From the Research Journal of the First Navigator. 12 years ago. Calder had been living with his mother for more than a year now, and for most of that time she had worked on some secret project. His questions, aimed at his tutors and at Alsa herself, revealed very little.
If I told you the details, his mother said, it wouldn't be much of a secret project, would it?
Arthur was even less forthcoming.
As you know, the Emperor formed the Black Watch to turn the Elder's own powers against them. Such knowledge is known to drive strong men insane. I would think 3 times before asking too many questions, and then 3 times again.
Voris adjusted his glasses and said nothing. Calder had gotten most of his information from the odd comment his mother left lying behind her as she went to work.
Bring me my jacket, would you? The breeze off the bay is biting. Don't head down to the harbor today, Calder. It's supposed to be dangerous. Whichever guild you choose, make sure it's not the Navigators. They're con men at best, pirates at worst.
The facts came in dribbles, months apart, but Calder and Jyrene kept their ears sharpened to catch each one. Today, they had finally decided to do some hands-on investigation. It was an unseasonably cold day in autumn, which gave them an excuse to wear hoods and heavy coats. If Alsa did spot them hovering around her workplace, she shouldn't be able to see much of their faces. Calder, after a moment's hesitation, belted a sword around his waist. There were so many around the Greyweather house that his mother would never notice a single one missing, and it was currently fashionable for men to wear blades in public. It made those who had grown up in the peaceful capital look like they could handle themselves in a fight, and a swordsman could never cause too much trouble with all the imperial troops carrying pistols. The sword would make him look older, so no one would think to find a 14-year-old inside his hood. Besides, his mother had been training him. If they were caught, he might be able to fight his way free. They snuck out of the house on the pretense of buying books down in the city, giving Arthur and Voris time to relax. Of course, the tutors were under the impression that the children would be chaperoned by Ulsa, and Ulsa that they were still under the care of their tutors. That lie had taken a tricky bit of coordination, but between them they'd managed it. So it was that Calder found himself walking down the streets of the capital toward the Candle Bay Harbor, Gyrene on his arm and a sword at his belt. He couldn't recall anything better happening to him in his entire life. After almost 2 hours of walking, Gyrene's grip tightened on his arm as the harbor came into view.
"Look at that," she whispered, pointing.
She didn't need to point. There was only one thing of interest happening in the harbor. A wooden scaffold covered most of the horizon, blocking off more than its share of the harbor. All the other ships were shoved off to one side, hull to hull with one another. The scaffolding was so thick that it might as well have been a wooden wall between them and the water. Here and there he caught glimpses of rope lines, a stretch of mast, a few yards of sail.
"Are they building a ship?"
Gyrene asked. Calder stared at the scaffolding as though he could will it to disappear.
"That might be a disguise. My mother hates the water, and she's certainly not a shipwright." "But what else could they possibly be doing?"
Left with no other obvious alternative, the two of them kept walking closer and closer to the harbor. The capital was vast, and Calder had never visited this particular harbor before. He had traveled to the Imperial Prison several times, but that building was all the way across Candle Bay. This side of the bay was a total mystery to him. Workers crawled all over the wooden frame, some shirtless and banging away with hammers, others wearing leather harnesses and dangling from climbing ropes. A man who looked like a magister stood on the dock, shouting something and waving a reddish staff over his head with both hands. Gyrene squeezed his arm again.
"Are you willing to get in trouble?"
They hadn't discussed the plan this far, but there was only one thing they could possibly do. He gave her a grin.
"You go left, I'll go right."
Without the slightest hesitation, Gyrene split off to the left, stuffing her hands into her coat pockets and walking down the dock. Calder moved to the right, doing the same. There was a reason they had chosen to wear coats of solid, unrelieved black. The Black Watch stood around the dock at the base of the scaffolding, but not standing guard. They probably didn't need to. One could easily tell a watchman by their black uniforms, and most people avoided the Black Watch at all costs. They were supposed to have power over elders. Unsavory rumors suggested that, if you interfered with a watchman in the course of her duties, you might find yourself face to face with the faceless. All of which worked to Calder's advantage. A knot of black-clad men and women stood around a makeshift table of stacked crates, arguing over what looked like a map.
"We need more iron,"
one of the women said.
"More iron? What, for ballast? Why should we keep building a trap if we can't catch anything?"
"We never will if we don't get another reader."
"Are the bindings in place?"
"That's Greyweather's area, but good luck finding her."
Calder's ears perked up at the mention of his mother, but he didn't show any reaction. He walked past the cluster of watchmen, armed with confidence and a black coat. One of the men nodded to him as he passed, and Calder nodded back from deep within his hood. Heart hammering, he ducked under the lowest wooden beam forming the box around the dock. No one tried to stop him. No one seemed to notice. Once he was past the scaffolding, he saw what his mother had been working on for the better part of the past year. The ship had a hull built of smooth wood, of a green so dark that it was almost black. There were no sails, leaving the mast sticking up like a tree with no leaves. Workmen bustled around the ship's deck, nailing planks down or moving brushes over the railing. Shimmering gold leaf on the side of the hull proudly announced the vessel's name, the Testament. But the most unusual aspect of the ship's construction lay on the docks. A pair of shackles, big enough to wrap around a whole house, sat unlatched on the docks. Each shackle was bolted to an enormous chain, which slithered down the dock and vanished under the water, terminating at some point under the ship. Far from enlightening him, the sight raised a forest of new questions. What was the point of dragging two enormous chains behind the ship? Wouldn't they anchor it in place? Were the shackles supposed to lock onto the ocean floor, or were they meant to hold something? A pair of chimera, perhaps? He had a sudden vision of this ship being pulled by two great sea serpents, the shackles wrapped around their necks like collars, and the idea seized his imagination. Perhaps there were no sails because this ship didn't need sails. It would move across the Aeon Sea solely under the propulsion of its captive beasts. but it didn't explain the greatest mystery.
Why does a ship like this need Blackwatch help?
He stood gazing at the vessel for a moment longer, hoping that Gyrene had managed to make it in here undetected, when he felt a metal point sticking through his coat on the back of his neck. An unfamiliar woman's voice spoke from behind him.
You're carrying steel. You know how to use it?
Let me draw it, and I'll show you, he said,
his mouth running away with itself. The woman laughed and pulled the point away from his neck.
It's a duel, then.
Calder turned, drawing his saber. Behind him, holding a curved saber almost identical to his own, stood a woman who looked nothing at all like a watchman. She wore no black, for one thing. A bright blue vest over a loose white shirt, a checkered scarf, and gray pants covered in more patches than original fabric. Her long hair, which she wore tied back, was the same shade of red as Calder's. When she saw him, her face fell, and she lowered her blade.
Elder's bones, she spat. I'm not picking on a kid. Get out of here before I put you in the water.
Calder pushed back his hood, then raised the point of his own saber.
You have beautiful hair.
Then he lunged, intending to prick her in the shoulder. That would teach her to underestimate an armed opponent. She slapped his blade away with hers, now grinning.
I could say the same to you.
She stepped forward, testing him with a short strike. Calder managed to turn it away. The woman was much, much faster than he'd expected. He needed to keep her talking.
What's your name, young lady?
Her eyebrows rose as she cut off a slice of his coat sleeve.
Young lady? Calyrax Balls, boy. I've got 10 years on you at least.
He feinted for her neck and then ducked low, aiming for her leg. Her arm seemed to move independently of her body, sliding his blade away without her reacting at all.
I'm Calder,
he panted, already losing his breath.
Jessica Bennett, member of the Proud Guild of Navigators and recently made Captain of the Eternal.
She didn't bother going on the offensive, waiting for him to take the initiative.
Calder Martin.
He took advantage of the space to give his breath time to return. A workman tried to edge his way around Cheska, but she pushed him off the dock without looking. He fell into the bay with a cry and a heavy splash.
Who taught you to fence? Your blind sister? His mother, actually,
Ulsa Greyweather said, peeling off her gloves as she hopped down from the ship. Calder hurriedly shoved his sword back down into its sheath, though Cheska glanced from one of them to the other.
Your son? Really? But he seems like so much fun. He takes after his father,
Ulsa said flatly, resting her hand on the hilt of her own sword. On her, it didn't look like a fashion statement.
I'm trying to teach him to act like an adult. By, for instance, not dueling strangers in public for no reason.
Cheska finally slid her blade away, still grinning.
Oh, don't make it like that. I caught somebody sneaking in, and I was having a little fun with him before I sent him away. Might say I'm checking up on your fencing lessons.
Alsa's grip tightened on her sword.
How would you like one of your own?
The navigator captain backed away, hands empty and raised.
Watch that temper, Greyweather. You might get somebody killed. See you again, Calder.
With a cheery wave, she walked off. Behind her, a grumbling workman hauled himself out of Candle Bay.
Navigators,
Ulsa spat. She turned to Calder, and her anger was undiminished.
I'll have you know that I caught Gyrene myself, and I have sent her straight back home. What do you suggest I do with you?
Calder looked up hopefully.
Give me a job?
Calder knew that, if he approached this situation carefully, he would end up locked at home under strict guard with most of his privileges suspended. So he decided to plunge recklessly forward.
Surely there's something I can do to help,
he said to his mother. She had escorted him some distance away from the harbor, and now the two of them sat at a small table in the shelter of a tea shop. Ulsa pinched the bridge of her nose.
This is guild business, Calder. Certainly we can always use more readers, but we haven't fallen so low as to recruit men as young as yourself.
She sounded certain, but Calder had seen the way her eyes drooped and her shoulders fell when she came home, sometimes late at night. They were working her ragged, which meant they didn't have many readers to choose from. Why not Calder? And if he was working on their special project, his mother couldn't punish him for sneaking around.
It looked to me like you can use every hand you can get. How many other readers do they have working here?
The guild is spread very thin lately. We were expected to have 3 more, but they were delayed on urgent business.
A thought struck Calder that had never occurred to him before.
Are you the only reader on this project?
Loose strands of Ulsa's hair fell over her eyes as she slumped over the table.
Two others started with me. First one was called off, and then the other, and they kept promising.
Suddenly the fatigue blew away from Ulsa like a hat in the wind, and she shot up from her seat. All the other voices in the shop drifted off into silence. Not knowing what else to do, Calder stood up too.
Guildhead,
Ulsa snapped, bowing crisply at the waist. A young woman stood on the inside of the shop door as it closed behind her. Her long hair, which almost brushed the floor, was so white as to be almost silver. The color probably came straight from an alchemist's bottle. She wore only a long black coat that covered her entirely from neck to ankles, with a line of silver buttons fastening down the front. At first glance, Calder thought she was his own age. Then he wondered if perhaps she might be younger. But as she walked closer to their table, she carried herself with the businesslike bearing of a much older woman. She did not sit, nodding first to Ulsa and then to Calder.
I spoke with Cheska, she said, and her voice was high and clear, like a child's. We had a visitor, didn't we?
Ulsa stared straight ahead, her back rigid.
Yes, ma'am. This is my son, Calder, ma'am.
The girl looked at him without any recognizable expression.
Calder Martin, I am Bliss.
What kind of a name is Bliss? He wondered, and it still bothered him that he couldn't tell how old she was. But his mother had called her Guildhead. The Black Watch did not publicize the name of their head, unlike the other guilds, which meant Calder was now privy to a secret hidden from most everyone in the whole empire. He bowed deeply at the waist.
I'm Calder Martin, Madam Bliss. I do apologize. Just Bliss. If you like, you can call me Guildhead.
She squinted as though she were having trouble seeing him properly.
Shouldn't we sit in an establishment like this?
In such chill and windy weather, the tea shop was somewhat packed. Over 24 people had turned to watch the three people in black coats standing stiffly instead of sitting with their tea. Calder slid into a seat next to his mother, trying not to blush. Bliss considered her chair as though she'd never seen one before, then abruptly plopped herself down.
What has your mother told you of our project down at the harbor, Calder Martin?
Nothing, Bliss, but...
Guildhead,
she corrected. He paused for a second. She had given him permission to call her by her name, hadn't she? But he continued nonetheless.
I'm sorry, Guildhead.
Bliss.
Bliss,
he repeated, confused.
Guildhead.
Now he was getting frustrated. He forced a smile.
What would you like me to call you, ma'am?
She shrugged.
I don't care. I wanted to know how long you'd put up with it.
She poured herself a cup of tea, and Calder realized that not only had his tea arrived, but she had stolen his cup. He rushed on, trying not to show his irritation.
My mother hasn't told me anything. I snuck down here against her will because I wanted to see what she was working so hard on. And from what I can tell, your guild is in desperate need of readers.
Bliss trailed a finger in her cup of tea, drawing lazy spirals in the liquid surface. It was hard to tell if she was paying any attention. Ulsa didn't say a word, nor did she pour herself any tea. She looked as if she had only sat down because her guild had required it.
I am quite a skilled reader, as it happens,
he went on. The Black Watch guild head nodded absently, sticking her finger in her mouth.